From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we go back to 1910 and the story of the biggest forest fire in American history and how it paradoxically saved the recently created National Forest Service. We'll talk with Timothy Egan about his new book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. Also, we talk with Ali Etaraz. His new memoir, Children of Dust, is about growing up in Pakistan, attending a madrasa, fervently studying Islam, and moving to the U.S. He describes his new memoir as being about what happened when he loved Islam with affection, with torment, with stupidity, with ardor bordering on obsession. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Timothy Egan, has written a new book about a forest fire in 1910 that's also a book about a culture war of that time. Egan's book, The Big Burn, tells the dramatic story of the largest forest fire in American history. It consumed 3 million acres in 2 days, burning through eastern Washington, northern Idaho, and western Montana, creating panicked evacuations. The fire started just 5 years after President Theodore Roosevelt created the National Forest Reserves and the National Forest Service. In 1910, with Roosevelt out of office and with President Taft being indifferent to the public lands, many members of Congress were hoping to zero out the Forest Service budget. Among the conservationist opponents were the railroad and the timber industries. While telling the story of the fire, Egan's book tells the political story of how the fire paradoxically saved the national forests and changed fire policy. Timothy Egan is also the author of a National Book Award-winning book about the Dust Bowl called The Worst Hard Time, and he's a columnist for The New York Times. Timothy Egan, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to tell the story of the fire, the Big Burn? What's the larger story it tells?
You know, we had fires a few weeks ago east of Los Angeles, and smoke drifted over the L.A. basin. And they were pretty good-sized fires, but they were 100,000 acres. This fire was 3 million acres. So that's an area the size of Connecticut burning in a weekend. Those fires burned for 10 days. This fire was 36 hours. So a day and a half, 3 million acres, 2,000 degrees, one of these crown fires where the thing goes from treetop to treetop and sucks all the oxygen out of every cave. It's sort of a monster that takes on a life of its own. But then it, you know, as a natural disaster, I think that's cool because, I mean, I guess I'm sort of drawn to natural disasters. But it has such amazing resonance. It's with us still in so many ways, both in the wrong lesson that was learned from it and in it becoming the creation myth that saved public land.
What do you know about how this massive fire got started?
Well, it was a very dry summer, and it stopped raining and snowing and sending anything down from the sky starting in April of 1910. So by the time June came around, which is pretty early in the northern Rockies, it's usually pretty cold there still, they already had some spot fires, their little lightning-caused fires. And by August, it just had the feel of death on the land, and everyone knew something was going to happen because there were all these little fires, these little lightning-caused fires, and it just blew up. A hurricane-force wind is 70 miles an hour or more. That's what caused this thing to blow up. This freak weather system came out of the eastern Washington. It's called a Palouser. And it just lifted up all these smaller fires, and it took everything to the sky, and the thing just blew up. So it was a freak convergence of a very dry summer and lightning, which caused all these smaller fires, and then this wind just lifting the thing up.
And there were little towns that had to be evacuated, and you tell some pretty vivid stories. This fire broke out in the public lands just as Teddy Roosevelt's National Forest Program was in jeopardy of getting zeroed out by Congress. So just give us a summary of, like, why Roosevelt created the National Forest Program in the first place.
Yes, absolutely. And the Forest Service was 5 years old when this fire happened. It happened in 1910. Roosevelt left office in 1909. His chief forester and top aide, Gifford Pinchot, was fired by Roosevelt's successor, William Taft, in 1910. So at the start of 1910, you have an orphan agency. It's lost its founder. It's lost the person who, you know, he was named Gifford Pinchot, and they were called Little Gifford Pinchots or Little GPs. They came out of Yale, and they were just infused with this idealistic image of the Great Crusade, this idea of conservation which Roosevelt and Pinchot had bequeathed to the world. So they leave this agency orphaned, and this Congress just starts picking and plucking it to death. It's death by a thousand blows. It was never popular to begin with. It was a radical idea, and then it was not popular in the West either. These young forest rangers would go out west, and they would find brothels and saloons. And I don't know if you've seen the television series Deadwood.
Exactly. That's exactly right. What it seemed like reading your book.
That's what it was. You know, it was the one town of Taft, Montana, named for the aforementioned 350-pound president, had three prostitutes for every man and a higher murder rate than New York City. And so one of these rangers came out, and he said he was just horrified. He gets out of Yale, and he shows up in the Lolo National Forest in Montana, and he wires back to Missoula, and he says, two undesirable prostitutes setting up business on national forest land. What should I do? And some smartass gets a hold of it and wires back, find two desirable ones. And so, you know, that's what they were dealing with. So they're hated by the people they're supposed to, you know, this Roosevelt idea of the little guy owning land. They don't give a rip about it. And then the Congress is killing them. They're just defunding this thing. These Gilded Age powers, it's the last sort of clash of the Gilded Age powers. And so they want this land for themselves. They're used to getting it for free. They're used to having their way with it.
And wait, and by the they, who do you mean here? It's like what, the railroads, the timber industry? Who else like wants the land?
The railroads were given more than 35 million acres for free, an area about the size of New England. You've also got the Rockefeller family, which is building the biggest and most expensive transcontinental railroad in history, right through the heart of the Bitterroot Mountains, right where the fire takes place. That's why all those people are living in those brothel-ridden saloon towns, is because they've just put this railroad together. And then you have the Guggenheims and E.H. Harriman and James J. Hill and the Weyerhaeusers, families that are largely known to us today probably only for their philanthropies. But then they were at the peak of their Gilded Age power, and they wanted this land because they were used to getting it for free. Roosevelt took it out of the general public domain and put it in the protectorate of the Forest Service, not the parks. That's different and much smaller. The Forest Service was to be the people's land. The people were going to use it. So they leave office, just to get back to your question, 1910. It's a long, dry summer. The forest rangers are reviled and hated. The agency itself is nearly defunded. They're making, you know, their pittance wages. They've lost their founder. And then the fire happens, and it has this, you know, it becomes their creation myth. It has this dramatic effect of saving the agency and making heroes and martyrs of the people out there.
It saved the agency how?
Well, the forest rangers themselves were called Sissies and Teddy's Green Rangers, and the fire happens, and it's the first time the United States has tried to fight a wildfire. They organized an army of 10,000 people, largely immigrants, some African-American buffalo soldiers, convicts, jails are opened up, people are let out of the jails. This huge army of people are sent to the West to fight this, then it's an emerging fire. It hasn't blown up yet. It's 1,000 little small fires. And they're made heroes. The press portrays them as heroic, as noble men, not the immigrants who died, but the rangers who fought this thing, who didn't have a clue what they were doing, by the way, and lost. You know, you can't say, you know, man versus nature, man wins. The fire kicked their rears. They lost, but it made them heroic, and it was covered all over the U.S. The New York Times had several page one stories. The European press covered it. So suddenly, public sentiment shifted, and you saw a dramatic effect in Congress where they refunded the agency, they doubled its budget, and they created this bill that had been lingering since Roosevelt's day to create national forest in the East. You would not have national forests in the Adirondacks in Virginia and Pennsylvania and New England without this fire.
And there were little towns that had to be evacuated, and you tell some pretty vivid stories about what the evacuations were like and the panic that ensued.
You know, I kept thinking, I hate to say this because it's kind of a stereotype, but I kept thinking of the evacuation scenes from the movie Titanic, which we've all seen, because they had a, you know, Victorian gentleman's like, women and children first, no men, but the men were shoved the women and children off the trains, and they had to have these buffalo soldiers at gunpoint with their fixed bayonets order the men off the trains. There was a last train out of Wallace, Idaho. You knew if you didn't get on that train, you were going to die. You were going to burn to death. A fellow came up to me not long ago. I was doing a reading on this book in Oregon, and he said, my grandmother got on that train, and she talked about it for the rest of her life, how she got on that last train out of town. If you didn't get on that train, you weren't going to live. And then once they got on the trains, they would get to these trestles over the valleys, and the trestles were burning. So they'd go hide in a cave. They'd back the train into one of these caves that would board through the Bitterroot Mountains. And once in the cave, the fire would find them because it was in search of oxygen. It was a beast. It was a force of its own. So I'll tell you backstory real quickly, though. The Buffalo soldiers, who were African-American soldiers who had always sort of done the dirty work of the United States Army and segregated only by, they had white commanding officers. They had put down Indian uprisings. They had put down labor wars in this place 5 years earlier when the labor unions went on basically a revolutionary spree and killed the governor, and there were strikes everywhere. They show up, and they're supposed to save this town, and they're greeted by the kind of racism that was typical of the day. They called them, the papers called them, dusky doughboys. And they would have stories about how they're strangely quiet. We would think they would be singing at night. And so all these sort of racial stereotypes were, but none of the folks who lived there thought these people could fight a fire. But the Buffalo Soldiers saved at least one town of Avery, Idaho, and were instrumental in saving another, the town of Wallace.
So once the fire spread and it was covering millions of acres, how were people recruited to fight the fires?
Well, they had done the recruiting in advance because there were all these little fires, and they wanted to get. They knew, you know, the towns were big. Towns were going to start to be in danger. Towns like Spokane and Missoula and possibly even Denver. So they were concerned. There were all these telegrams back to Taft, who was vacationing on, as they said, in his yachting costume, was another term they used. Taft was a poor. He was so criticized because of his weight and everything else. But Taft would get these telegrams saying, you know, we're going to lose the town if you don't get people out here. So he sent the army and he recruited. So they found all these immigrants. People were willing to fight fire for 25 cents an hour, which is what they paid them. So they had 10,000 people in place when the blow up happened. And they were scattered all over the woods with shovels, doing a little bit of, you know, here and there work trying to stop these tiny fires. And then the blow up happens and it's just all hell breaks loose.
You know, in the 21st century, it's hard enough to fight the wildfires in California. What was the state of forest fire fighting in 1910 when this fire broke out?
They had no clue what they were up against. They had no formal firefighting training, no manuals to consult. All these men are in place, and they're wearing, you know, khaki pants and wide-brimmed floppy hats and terrible shoes and no socks, and they're hungry. Every one of them, you see the pictures of them, they look really skinny, like war veterans. They're eating these giant pots of potatoes and beans, which are stirred up in the fire camps. And they're mostly two Italian immigrants back to their home in Italy. It was the peak of Italian immigration in the United States. So there's a lot of Italian immigrants in there. And when they died, the papers didn't even call them by name. They would say, you know, Joe Smith died and Hiram Johnson and two Italians. So they weren't even given their proper name. But so they're in place, and they just have a shovel. That's all it is. They're just out there trying to dig a fire line, trying to scrape away a little bit of dirt so that when the fire comes up upon them, it won't advance anymore. And so they were just, you know, I hate to use this term, but they just became fuel. And when they found their bodies later, most of them were not even recognizable as human forms. They were just these black, encrusted, you know, burnt carbon, basically.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Egan, and he's been writing about the American West for years for the New York Times. His new book is called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about the fire and its consequences. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Egan. He's been writing about the American West for the New York Times for years. He has a column in the Times now. He's the author of a book about the Dust Bowl called The Worst Hard Time. Now he has a book called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. And this is a 3-million-acre fire that burned in 1910 across the West. And it's the fire that Egan says helped save the National Forest Service from being zeroed out by Congress. Some of the main characters in your story were really broken by this fire. And one of them is Gifford Pinchot, who was the founding director of the National Forest Service. And why was he a broken man after the fire?
Well, Pinchot, by the way, is just a fascinating guy. I mean, he lived from 1864, when the Civil War still raged, till 1946, when World War II was over. Was not only Roosevelt's top advisor, he was the Rahm Emanuel to Roosevelt's Barack Obama, but later became a two-term governor of Pennsylvania and an advisor to Franklin Roosevelt. It was his idea to come up with the Civilian Conservation Corps. But he was a son of privilege, a strange guy. His grandfather had clear-cut much of the state of Pennsylvania. It was a deforester.
But clear cut, you mean he cut down the trees?
Right, he cut down all the trees. That's how they got rich. So Pinchot comes from this hugely wealthy family. One of his homes was called Gray Towers in overlooking the Delaware. And there were 63 turrets and 23 fireplaces in this castle that was one of Pinchot's three homes. He goes to Yale. He's a skull and bones. He's, he's this child of privilege. And he had this was Roosevelt's term, peculiar intimacy was the quote, with Teddy Roosevelt. They met at a young age. They used to wrestle and box, strip down to their skivvies while, kind of a D.H. Lawrence sort of thing. But Roosevelt had this wrestling mat installed in the governor's office, the governor's mansion in Albany. And when Pinchot would come up to see him, he'd unroll the mat and they'd go at it. And Pinchot in his memoir described how one of the highlights of his life was boxing with Roosevelt and knocking him on his butt. So Roosevelt becomes president, Pinchot's his top aide, and together they try to do something audacious. They do create the idea of conservation. Now, John Muir is the third character in this, but he's off stroking his beard and making wonderful statements and living in his vineyard north of San Francisco. You can see I'm tweaking Muir quite a bit here because he always gets nothing but positive press. But Pinchot and Roosevelt are doing the heavy lifting of creating the lasting conservation movement that we have: national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges. And so, when the fire happens, Pinchot realized that, like all people who can see public policy moments, they need their creative myth setting. They need their launch point. He could see that this would be the fire that would save the agency. So he immediately went on the attack, he and Roosevelt. Roosevelt was touring the West, reviving his popularity. He would soon run as a Bull Moose third-party candidate against his successor, Taft. And they used this fire as the rallying cry to save conservation. So Pinchot, though he was heartbroken by what had happened, you quickly realize that this thing could be the thing that launches, that saves conservation.
So what did he do to use the fire to save conservation?
He wrote a million op-ed pieces. There were page one stories everywhere saying, Pinchot was as prominent as any public official that you can think of today. One of the things I talk about was how they formed conservation. They used to go for these long walks in Rock Creek Park, or Roosevelt and Pinchot would skinny dip in the Potomac, and I was thinking, what would it be like if, God forbid, Karl Rove and Bush were skinny dipping together in the Potomac while thinking of ways to deregulate the banks even more. And the Secret Service would hold their clothes while they would swim naked in the Potomac on a cold November day. And it was like a triathlon whenever you went out with Roosevelt. And so, the way they used this fire was to use their connections. They gave speeches, they wrote op-eds. Roosevelt had huge crowds because he had been away for a year. He was the most popular American in the world. The Vatican greeted him. The huge crowds greeted him all over Europe and Africa, everywhere he went. So he comes home after being away for a year, and he's mobbed. And Pinchot wrote most of his speeches. Pinchot was his voice.
So, in talking about how Pinchot tried to use the fire to save the endangered National Forest Service, you write a little bit about what he was up against. For example, a senator from Idaho, from one of the towns that burned, Wallace, Idaho.
Yes.
Weldon Heyburn. He called this fire God's will. He said it was the will of an angry God enraged by the Forest Service. Was that a widely held view?
I think it was. I actually think there were a lot of people when he said that. If you read the newspaper reaction to that, at least in the West, a lot of people said, the man speaks truth. They thought that God was sweeping away these trees, which had been or being protected by this Forest Service, sweeping away to make room for settlers. And so, this Senator Heyburn was always after Roosevelt, as were most of Western senators. They just couldn't stand the Forest Service. They were against progressive era thoughts like clean meat inspection and minimum wage and child labor laws. But more than anything else, they were against the idea of national forests. So when the fire came along, they saw it as something that would work to their advantage, the final nail in the coffin. But in fact, public sentiment was with the Forest Service, made heroes of them.
I'm wondering if there was something of a little culture war going on back in 1910 at the time of this fire.
There wasn't a little cultural war, Terry. There was a big cultural war. These people could not have been more out of place there, these Yale-trained foresters in the Deadwood United States of the West. And also, you know, they thought these two plutocrats, these two men of privilege, Roosevelt and Pinchot, were trying to foist something radical on them, even though they said they were doing it for the little guy. And that's what, you know, so you had this, the idea that the National Forests are for the little guy, a populist progressive thing, versus everyone else, meaning a lot of people trying to make a buck off the place, and then bigger people trying to say, you know, how dare you try to do this? We'd always gotten the land for free. I mean, the railroads got their 35 million acres. The Speaker of the House, Joe Cannon, said, not 1 cent for scenery. So there was a huge culture war going on. And one more thing on this, and I'll be quiet, is that there, the cleave in the Republican Party that happened largely at the time of this fire, with Roosevelt then running as a bull moose progressive, set the stage for the Republican Party for the next 100 years. It then was the so-called, and this is not my term, that's their term, progressive party, the party that was progressive on race, on conservation. The Democrats were considered the racists, and they fought conservation. When Roosevelt left and took this wing with him, it set the stage for the party that would be Herbert Hoover, Barry Goldwater, George Bush. All of that was set by Roosevelt breaking, taking that progressive side with him.
Timothy Egan will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Anti Records, with the swell season, featuring Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova, from the film Once. Their new album, Strict Joy, is available now. And from Subaru, with the safety and performance of all-wheel drive on every vehicle. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. This is NPR.
Coming up, we talk with Ali Etiraz, whose memoir is about growing up in Pakistan, loving Islam with ardor bordering on obsession, then moving to the U.S. and after 9/11, rethinking his understanding of Islam. And Timothy Egan tells us some of the lessons learned from the Big Burn, the Great Fire of 1910. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Timothy Egan, author of the new book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. It's about the biggest forest fire in American history that burned through parts of three western states in 1910. That fire paradoxically saved the National Forest Reserves, which had been created by Roosevelt just 5 years earlier. Before the fire, many members of Congress were preparing to zero out the Forest Service budget. There were lessons learned from this huge fire, but the question is, different people learn different and contradictory lessons. So
yes,
let's talk about some of the contradictory lessons that came out of this.
That's why this fire is with us still. It's not just a great tale. It's a story that's embedded into all these agencies. Now, the Forest Service was set up, as I mentioned, as this progressive era, you know, Gifford Pinchot, Teddy Roosevelt trained idealistic young men, and they were mostly all men. But after the fire, the Forest Service became the Fire Service. And to this day, more than half of their budget is spent fighting wildfires. And that wasn't the original intent. They weren't set up to put out what is essentially part of nature. And so after the fire, about 10 years afterward, they started something called the 10 o'clock rule, which was that if a fire happened on your watch on a given day, it must be put out by 10 o'clock the next day, or you had to suffer reprimand and severe consequences. So Norman McLean, the great Montana writer who wrote A River Runs Through It and also a meditation on fire called Young Men in Fire, talked about how this had horrible consequences. He said every young ranger had 1910 on the brain for most of the 20th century. So they dedicated themselves. The fire did save America in saving the Forest Service, but thereafter their mission changed. Their mission was to put out fires. And to this day, when you see these, you know, the fire industrial complex, giant planes dropping retardants on mountains east of Los Angeles and around Colorado, and huge armies of yellow-shirted firefighters going up there with bulldozers and all of that. That's still a direct consequence of this fire, of the Forest Service deciding to put it out.
Wait. What's wrong with that?
I don't think anything's wrong or right with it, but I'll tell you what causes trouble is that by resisting nature, fire is a force of nature, you allow all this fuel to build up. And the public land agency
fuel being dry wood, dead trees.
Right. Dead trees, standing timber that nature needs to burn. There are many species of trees in the West that won't regenerate without fire. Lodgepole pine, the cones won't open. They can't have sex. They can't carry on without fire. They need fire to reproduce. So, and Pinchot knew this, but he sort of hid that. A lot of people. So, by trying to put out every fire, they'd put it in a little box. And then some of the bigger fires we had, starting in 1988 with the Yellowstone fire, continuing to this day in some of the fires that happened in Arizona a few years ago, which were catastrophic, are a result of trying to put out every fire and then having all the standing timber lying around that once a fire comes along, boom, it just becomes catastrophic. And this is not my contention. My contention is on other things, but this is universally recognized. So now you have something called the Let Burn policy, where they are letting fire. This dates to the Yellowstone fire of 1988, where they're letting fire back into the woods, but only here and there. The problem is that so many people have moved. Something like 20 million people now live within a few miles of a national forest. And when they see fire, they're terrified. And they call their congressman, and their congressman calls the regional forest supervisor, and they say, how come you're not putting this fire out? And he says, well, it's in an area where we have to let it burn. They say, well, it's also in an area where, you know, 20 of my constituents live, and they not only vote, but they contribute. So there's political pressure there. And that's what, when you see some of these big firefighting campaigns, a lot of it is because of politics. Is somebody saying, you know, any honest firefighter will tell you somewhat ruefully that they end up fighting to save people's summer homes.
Since your new book has so much to do with the National Forest Service, I'm wondering if you've thought about, and I'm sure you have, what America would look like had there not been a National Forest Service created by Teddy Roosevelt in the early part of the 20th century.
Consider this. Roosevelt basically bequeathed us with an area about the size of France that every American owns. That's our birthright as an American citizen to own a piece of that. The parks were less than 10% of that. They get all the attention because the so-called, I hate to use this term, but people keep using it, eco-porn. You know, there's glorious shots in HD of Yosemite or Grand Tetons, but the true nature of public land is something different. It's a more rumpled area. It's a river that seldom gets visited. It's a ridgeline, you know, up in the clouds in far northeast Montana. It's a prairie grass in Nebraska. It's not the stuff that gets, you know, all the nature photographs, and that's what we own. Now, had Roosevelt not set aside this, and he did it by executive order. There were, you know, Congress changed the laws later, but he largely did it by executive order. I mean, he famously said when he created the first wildlife refuge, he asked his attorney general, he said, is there any law that will prevent me from declaring Pelican Island, this is in Florida, a federal bird reserve? And his attorney general told him there was no such law. And Roosevelt said, very well, then I do so declare it. And that's how the National Wildlife Refuge System was started. And when they created the National Forests, I mean, they brought in these maps and put them on the floor of the White House. And Roosevelt was just, you know, glorying in this all this land and drawing boundaries. He said, oh, have you put the Flathead Valley in there yet? I was up there once and I saw a beautiful stand of timber and these elk up in the valley. Have you put that valley in as National Forest? So imagine had we not had him. It's one of these great what-ifs of history. What would the land that was left over from the Louisiana Purchase? That's what this was. This wasn't private land. This was public domain land left over from stuff we got from Napoleon back in 1803, or was the Louisiana Purchase in 1801? Someone will correct me on that. But this is public domain land. And had we not set it aside and put it into a professionally managed group, it would have been sold off as it was at the time to periodic groups. And we would not have, I mean, I grew up in Eastern Washington State with a large family. We didn't have any money. We didn't have a summer home. We didn't summer anywhere. I never even heard that term as a verb until later. My New York Times colleagues, who some of whom summered in France. But we had public land. And we would go camping in the Bitterroot Mountains where this fire happened. I saw this stuff as a little kid. I saw some of the standing dead timber. We would camp in the St. Joe River, a glorious place full of cutthroat and wildlife. And my mother always told me, we are rich because we have this. And it was ingrained into me as a little kid that I was wealthy because I owned a piece of this land. So what if it had not been set aside? I mean, you'd have this. I lived in Italy for a while, and they have a couple of national parks, but largely the nice land is owned by somebody. It's fenced off. England is the same situation. If you want to go hunt or fish or hike, you usually have to ask the lord of the manor or get permission to hike through his place. So, it's extraordinary to think how different we would have been without this endowment.
Timothy Egan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks for having me.
Timothy Egan is the author of the new book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. He's also a columnist for The New York Times. Coming up, a memoir about studying Islam with an ardor bordering on obsession, then becoming a reformist. We talk with Ali Etiraz about his book, Children of Dust, A Memoir of Pakistan. This is Fresh Air. Ali Etiraz says his new memoir is about what happened when he loved Islam with affection, with torment, with stupidity, and with an ardor bordering on obsession. It's also about trying to figure out his identity, growing up in Pakistan in the 80s, attending a madrasa, and then at the age of 11, moving with his family from Pakistan to the U.S. He was living in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, and after the attack, his ambition changed. He wanted to reform Islam. Etiraz is a graduate of Emory University and Temple Law School. After working in corporate litigation, he turned to writing about Islam and Pakistan. His articles have been published in Dissent, Foreign Policy, Alternet, Alt-Muslim, The Guardian, and Pakistan's English language daily, Dawn. And he has his own blog. His new memoir is called Children of Dust. Ali Etiraz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, your story strikes me as the story of a lot of American kids and teenagers, in that so many Americans struggle with their identity and they try on several different personalities when they become teenagers and different styles of dressing, sometimes different names or nicknames until they finally figure out who they really are. It seems to me you did that, but every step of the way it was about your relationship to Islam. Is that an accurate description?
That's absolutely accurate. I went through numerous phases, all relating to types of Muslim identities that I adopted. And it wasn't something conscious. It wasn't that I set out to do something along those lines. But it ended up becoming that because, for better or for worse, Islam in America and across the world has such diversity and plurality that I could often find myself into various different ways of being Muslim.
Now, your father made a pilgrimage to Mecca before you were born. What did he vow on that pilgrimage?
Well, there were two significant pilgrimages in a very early stage of my life to Mecca. First one was just my dad, and he went there. And he basically said to God, you know, please give me a son. And if you give me a son, then I'll make sure that the son becomes a servant of Islam. And the second pilgrimage was after I was born. We, as a family, all three of us went to Mecca again. And then my mother, along with my dad this time, sort of affirmed the fact that I was a boy, and therefore that first vow would have to be upheld.
Did your parents try to do anything to help you fulfill the vow that your father had made, that you would be a servant of Islam?
Absolutely. You know, they enrolled me in religious schooling pretty early.
Madrasa?
Yes, madrasa, as well as private tutors, as well as just at home.
The impression I took away from your description of the madrasa was that it was a really punitive place, a physically abusive place. And my impression was that you had more to say about that than what was actually taught there. What were your impressions of the school?
The madrasa, in a way, so, you know, I was really young. I was about 8 or 9, and it had such a atmosphere of almost totalitarian power over you. You know, you went in there, you just felt crushed. And I went in there as someone who sort of agreed with the idea of going there. You know, I was kind of okay with it. Whereas my friends and people around the neighborhood, they really didn't like to go. And I went in there as someone who was very comfortable learning about Islam. I thought I would just be learning the Quran and I would do well. That was really the entirety of my point of view. And I went in there and it just kind of blew me away as to how not only regimented everything was, And the regimentation occurs through discipline via theology. So you're supposed to wash your hands and feet in only one particular way when you're doing the ablution. You're supposed to bow, and then the instructors will check if you're bowing correctly. I mean, if your back is not perfectly straight, then you, depending on their mood, you might be disciplined, right? You had to sit, and this is described in the book. You know, you have to sit in that particular way, and I describe it in the book. It was not something that everyone can do, you know. So all of these things kind of occurred at the madrasa as soon as I went. And then there is the whole coming to the Arabic language thing, which is not our native language in Pakistan. We speak Urdu or Punjabi, and Arabic is pretty foreign.
So you were at a disadvantage as a Muslim just by virtue of the language that you spoke.
Right, right. But that's all of us. And so all of us, because none of us spoke Arabic, you know, we learned that lesson very quickly. And it took away immediately from any interest I had from the Quran. It took away from any interest that I had, oh, well, I'm going to learn Islam. It just kind of, that's the stuff you start fixating on. You know, it's just this little things. And the way you urinate, for example, what things you say before you go to the bathroom, all of these things kind of coalesced and just gave you such a feeling of fear.
Since you had such a bad experience at the madrasa, mm-hmm. when you were a boy, why did you kind of stick with Islam? I mean, like some people, if they have a bad experience at a religious school, they leave and they're never going back to church or synagogue or, you know, whatever their religion is. But you kept changing your relationship to Islam, but staying very committed to it.
Absolutely. Because I felt that I owed something to Islam. I owed my allegiance to it. I felt like I needed to remain committed to it because that's who I was supposed to be. And that's kind of my mission, if you will, to remain involved, to find myself within Muslim communities and be involved. And I do think that if I hadn't left Pakistan and come to the U.S., I may have veered away from Islam, like many youngsters who remain in Pakistan do. I recently met some of these guys in Dubai, and they had also gone to madrasas, you know, as little kids, and now they're atheist and they just have no interest in Islam and they never had maintained any interest in it, right? But I felt like once I came to the U.S., it got reinforced.
How? And,
well, because when we came to the United States, first of all, we were economically down. And second of all, we didn't really have a sense of Pakistani identity and we didn't really know what American identity meant. So the thing that kind of we grasped onto was Islam. And that was this like self-perpetuating, you know, reinforcing thing that we encountered over and over. And it was available all over New York. There were mosques that you could go to, little study circles that you could attend. And Islam became the identity marker, as opposed to, hey, I'm Pakistani, or hey, I want to be an American, right? It was just like, oh, I'm Muslim. That's who I am. I'm in a land of non-Muslims, and I'm a Muslim. That's who I have to be.
You were living in a neighborhood in New York with Hasidic Jews, Italians, African Americans, Albanians, very multicultural area.
Yeah.
So when people identified you as Muslim, was it with respect or derision?
It was with disinterest. People didn't really used to care that you were Muslim.
This is before 9/11.
Yeah, this is like early 90s, you know?
Right.
The only real thing that they could even associate me with was Apu from The Simpsons, and he's Hindu, right? So it was just one of those things that never really manifested itself.
You went back to Pakistan briefly.
Yes.
And suddenly, you were the American.
Right.
And a lot of your friends and their friends had turned against America. We're almost holding you responsible for everything they didn't like about America. And suddenly you, the person who's kind of still alienated in America, is in the position of defending it. Can you talk a little bit about being in that position?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I describe in the book, I first went to Karachi, which is a big, big city on the coast in Pakistan. And once I got there, I was like aghast at their westernization. You know, I was like, my God, you guys are so American. Like, what is wrong with you? Why don't you have more Islamic flavor to your life? What's with all the MTV style shows? Why don't you guys go to the mosque more? That was really my perspective. And then I go down to Punjab, back to my family in the rural areas. And suddenly, like I said, I meet these proto-Taliban guys, and they're trying to trick me. They're trying to play games with me, mess with my head about how I'm a CIA agent, how I'm American, how I'll never fit in with them, how I'm responsible for having brought upon, you know, the missile attacks that Clinton had launched against Afghanistan, and a lot of these other things. And I suddenly become a stand-in for the entirety of the West. And that struck me as completely crazy, because in New York, right, I was better than the Westerners. I was Muslim. And now all of a sudden I was a Westerner. You know, that has not gone away, like, to this day. That idea where a Muslim is not allowed to be an individual and is not allowed to, it hasn't really gone away. I feel like even today, especially after 9/11, I'm almost always standing in for somebody's historical grievances. And in some cases, fundamentalists think that I, by virtue of certain adoptions of, you know, American culture, I am now responsible for the whatever atrocities that their people have suffered. And then non-Muslims who are prejudiced towards Muslims just look at a public Muslim person like me and then they say, well, you represent all the vile things that Muslims have done to us.
My guest is Ali Etraz. His new book is called Children of Dust, A Memoir of Pakistan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ali Etraz. His new book is called Children of Dust, A Memoir of Pakistan. It's about growing up in Pakistan in the 80s, then moving with his family to the U.S. at the age of 11. He describes himself as having been devoted to Islam with an ardor bordering on obsession, until later dedicating himself to reforming the religion. You describe 9/11.
Yeah.
Second plane hits the tower.
Yeah.
Second plane hits the second tower. And you're thinking, I hope these aren't Muslims.
Right.
Why did that go through your mind?
I just felt like there was going to be a massive...
First of all, you suspected they were Muslims. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been
right.
thinking
no,
that.
Right. No, my first reaction was, it's got to be Muslims. Like, I just, you know, because going back to what those guys have been talking about in Pakistan, I just felt like it has to be. And then I was like, well, I hope it's not. And all of a sudden, I am a public Muslim. I mean, every Muslim is now, you know, a stand-in for what has happened. And I remember very distinctly that day when I was watching the programming. Yes, I was concerned about what had happened and, you know, the fact that the towers collapsed and the amount of people and the firefighters and their bravery. You know, I was definitely following that, but there was a second thread in my head where I was following anybody who said something to make sure that Muslims were not targeted. There was a very sudden fear that Muslims in the United States were about to be sent off to concentration camps. I mean, that, like the internment camps of the Japanese. So all of a sudden, I felt really visible. And that visibility caused not just me, but I will say a great number of American Muslims just hide, just tuck their head in and hide.
At some point, you decided you were going to become a reformer.
Yeah.
And try to reform Islam and to, you know, address head on the kind of radicalism that had become the public face of Islam to so many people.
Yeah.
And this is where you changed your name to the name that you currently use, Ali Etiraz.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose this name?
Well, I started becoming involved in Islamic reform type movements and groups because I felt that there were, it started striking me that there was something more than just political conflict at taking place here. I felt like maybe there was something about religion itself that was playing a role. And I had not really been involved with anything Islamic for about 5 years. And then, you know, I thrust myself back into it, into, again, sort of being a Muslim activist. And I think the Danish cartoons that occurred, those, you know, the Danish newspaper, which made some caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, it upset me that they were insulting Muhammad. But it felt to me that it was because of the things that Muslims had done. So we had kind of almost brought it upon ourselves, right? And if I wanted to restore some sort of civility amongst Muslims and non-Muslims, and I felt that I adopted this name, Ali Etiraz, which for me had very sort of activist connotations.
What does it mean?
Well, it means the noble protest. So the word Etiraz means protest. And I felt like I was protesting not just against the kind of character making, you know, Islam bashing non-Muslims, but also the sort of the violent fanatic extremists from the Muslim side. And it was that space in the middle, and I wanted to occupy it, and I felt like we could strengthen it. And it was really just, I think that never in my life had that original covenant that my dad and had sort of entered me into had been stronger than when I entered this sort of Ali Etiraz phase, which is funny because, you know, a lot of the critics of my activism from the Muslim community would think that I was sort of veering away from Islam. In fact, I mean, I was now totally and truly obsessed, as like I had never been before.
You had a friend who told you that he thought you'd made Islam into an idol.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That really struck me because...
And Islam does not allow idolatry.
Right. Islam is really just big against idolatry. And I totally value that comment because Islam had just become an edifice, this sort of, you know, like the obelisk in Arthur Clarke's, you know, Space Odyssey, that big black thing. It was just there. And I was always just kind of coming back to it. And I really didn't know why. So that final sort of change reminded me, you know what, like I have to figure some things out. And so now I'm kind of in a pretty chill place with respect to Islam, at least.
So what is your place in respect to Islam?
Well, I'm not really in the communal side of things. I rarely go to mosque. I do have a relationship, you know, with God, and I feel comfortable with that. I know that a lot of my outlook and a lot of my thinking is informed by Muslim traditions and Muslim cultures, and you know, the form of prayer that I take will take a historically Muslim appearance. And I'm comfortable with that.
So now that the form of Islam you practice is just a very personal one, how do your parents feel about that? Do they feel like you've lost your way as somebody who your father vowed would be a servant of Islam?
I don't think my parents think that. I mean, we've talked about this at length now. They are more pleased that I found a place where I could find happiness with, you know, my relationship to Islam. They are glad that I'm not coerced. You know, I don't have the feeling of being coerced by any historical fact, you know. My mom and I talked at length. Again, you know, she was the agent for so much of my Islamic obsession. And now we talk a lot about how we got to that point and how she got to that point. So it's kind of been eye-opening for both of us. My dad is probably not as happy that I'm so kind of removed from the community, but he's not upset either. You know, I think he appreciates that I got here genuinely. And I am kind of lucky because as I was going through my transformations, they were going through their own. And, you know, I'm sure they could write a book like this about themselves and their relationship. And I think that they're pretty much at ease.
Ali Etiraz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ali Etiraz is the author of the new book, Children of Dust, A Memoir of Pakistan. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to an interview with the photographer Roy DeCarava, who died this week at the age of 89. He was born in Harlem and dedicated his 60-year career to documenting African-American life, taking pictures of the everyday as well as the iconic. Duke Ellington was one of his many subjects. Join us for the next Fresh Air.